Okay, thank you all for being here. And I have to thank Kendall for really setting me up well to talk about San Francisco Unified School District. I'd also like to actually begin by thanking my co-investigators, which is Dr. Rajiv Bhatia, who is head of environmental health for the Department of Public Health, and Zeta Riker, who is assistant director of San Francisco Unified School District. And this, I do not have any financial relationships to disclose. This research has been funded by my department, San Francisco Department of Public Health, as well as the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. I had a feeling that the presenters who came before me would really give a great background on competitive food and that I wouldn't have to do too much. So, as we all know, the school food environment is complex. It includes a lot of different things. Competitive food is found in a la carte, vending machines, snack bars, student sales, and this is a picture actually of a student store before it got shut down at one of our high schools in San Francisco. Competitive foods are very common, as we heard, especially at middle and high. The first part of the presentation is really going to be more about sort of the policy background that's looking at the impact on revenue of competitive food. But then the second part we'll be talking about our research in San Francisco, and I'm hoping that I can help you, Kendall, with a little bit of your work there. We did not have in San Francisco any competitive food at our middle and high school. And the reason, and the other side is I really want to just focus on the impact, not just of the nutrition of competitive food, but impact on program finances and student participation. There's been growing concern that we heard that, and I'm really focusing on a la carte sales at this point, which is generally the sales that are done by the School Food Service Authority itself. And looking at the negative impact on NSLP participation and program revenue. But the challenge is, as we heard, that food service directors are generally believe that it's essential for the financial stability of their program to have these a la carte or competitive food sales. But through the USDA cost study, we did find that there are two things at play here that make it really important, that reimbursements from the federal government for the cost of paying for these for producing reimbursable meals is not keeping up with the cost of doing that. The research showed that school food authorities' revenues are only covered, they only covered 82% of the full cost of producing the meals, and revenues from reimbursable meals only cover 92% of the full cost. And the other thing that the USDA cost study found, it was really sort of enlightening, was that the non-program food, which is the food that is not the reimbursable meals, it may be being subsidized from NSLP funds. And that's a real problem. That's actually not supposed to happen. The analysis showed that the reported cost, and this was a cost that the school food authorities actually reported during this study, that they had underpriced their non-reimbursable meals by 29%. But when you looked at the full cost of it, when the total audit of the program and everything that it took to produce those non-program foods was taken into account, that showed that the revenues from non-reimbursable meals covered only 61% of the full cost of producing them. So in general, school food programs are very constrained environments, financially constrained, and for especially for reimbursable meals, to be able to be improved, they need money. So this is why we were really challenged by this problem. Some recent policy changes have actually been incredibly helpful to this issue. The first sort of bringing this issue to light, some of the first researchers were actually a colleague of ours here in San Francisco that runs an organization called Campaign for Better Nutrition, produced a report that showed, it's called Flunking Lunch, and it showed that the subsidies from NSLP were subsidizing these competitive foods that weren't available to children that did not have money to pay for them. So that's an equity issue, that's a justice issue, and it needed to stop. It was also reported by, I believe, the Center for Budget Policy and Priorities also issued a report on it. And then it was also included in Michelle Obama's task force report, the Task Force on Childhood Obesity, that program foods, the reimbursable meals need to be covering only the cost of producing reimbursable meals, and the competitive foods should not be being subsidized from NSLP funds. An interim rule was issued after the child nutrition reauthorization, and that was in June of last year, that defined now program food to be food sold in a participating school other than reimbursable meals and purchased using funds from the nonprofit school food service account of the school food authority. It also required that the revenue from non-program foods must generate revenue at least equal to the cost of such foods. But it's unfortunate that cost accounting is not required. I know it's very very administratively difficult, and because of that, it is not required between the two programs, between the non-program, the competitive foods, and the reimbursable meals. There is not a requirement for cost accounting generally. And because of that, the interim rule created this proxy formula to try to get at this issue of not taking money from the competitive food program from the National School Lunch Program to subsidize competitive food. But we're concerned because this proxy formula could be ineffective, especially in programs that have higher labor costs for non-program food. And I'll go into a little bit more how that could happen. One thing that we were really happy to see, though, was a policy memo issued in August of this year that actually expanded the definition of overt identification. And overt identification is something that's been prohibited since the early days of the National School Lunch Program, and basically saying that you cannot overtly identify a student as being poor, and you cannot overtly identify them through your method of food service. And generally, this was thought to be like tokens are not allowed. So you cannot different color tokens for different, like for the free children or for the children with reduced price meals, that you cannot overtly identify those children that are getting higher subsidies. But the USDA never really considered separate service lines between competitive foods and the National School Lunch to be a case of overt identification. Well, this has also changed now. They expanded the definition of overt identification and include guidance on school food authorities that are selling competitive food. And one of the things that was specifically prohibited is separate dining areas, separate service times, or separate service lines. We felt that the even existence of competitive food could have an impact on participation because of stigma. And we're very happy to see this policy memo issued. So now I'm going to go a little bit more now into the San Francisco Unified School District. And I have worked with the school district. I am a local public health employee, but I've worked with the school district for over 10 years. It's my strongest business partner in San Francisco. And because it is the biggest food service program in any school, in almost any town, it is most important that we work on this program. Our student population, I'm giving the dates from 09-10 to 10-11 because our study is actually looking at eliminating competitive food. And this is after a series of nutrition policies that we set around competitive food. We decided in 09-10, after some pilots, that the district was going to eliminate it completely. So that's why I'm going to go into the data from this area, from this time period. But the student population is around 55,000 students. About 54% were qualified for free and reduced. At this point, it's a little higher. It's more around 61%. The data from this year is not in yet, but it's around 61% free and reduced. As I said before, our elementary schools did not have competitive food, so just focusing on the middle and high school populations, we have over 25,000 students in middle and high, and about 56% of those are qualified for free and reduced. We have 13 middle schools, 17 high schools. We have traditionally a low participation in our breakfast and lunch. Our average daily participation in meals is only 22,000. That's only around 40% of the total student population, which is pretty low. Only 59% of the free and reduced students in the district are participating at this point, and only 41% of free and reduced middle and high school students are participating. So we really felt that this existence of a competitive food program could be partially impacting our participation in the program. A little bit of background, though, on our local school district. As Kendall talked about, we've had a very strong wellness policy. Our Board of Education required a wellness policy be created, and that was in 2002. We worked on it in 2003, and Leah Remkes helped work on it, who's in the room. And it was passed in 2003, and it covered the entire school food environment, and it has been updated since then, in 2007. We passed stronger nutrition standards than NSLP for our school meals. We established pretty strong nutrition standards for our a la carte food sales. We banned the sales of food at student-run snack bars, and student fundraising sales were limited to 4 times a year, which is actually a state law that just wasn't being enforced. And our vending machines, we set nutrition standards for them and required them to be shut down during the lunch period. So that was back in 2003. But we've gotten to the point where we've eliminated our a la carte meal program. And since the early 70s, I actually have archival financial data on the program. From the early 70s, and we had a very strong competitive food program then. We had a lot of the students that were paid status that were participating in the a la carte program. So we have a long, long history of a strong, robust, competitive food program in our middle and highs. Elimination, as I said, of our a la carte was identified as a priority due to low participation in national school lunch. We felt like it could reinforce the stigma, and especially as I go into how the lines were set up, we actually had two separate programs. It had evolved to be this way, where we had our national school lunch program was in one line, and we had implemented salad bars at all the middle and highs in about 2006 or 7. But our national school lunch program meal had devolved to be a pre-plated meal that was being purchased from an outside vendor. And our competitive food program was actually located in geographically different areas of the school. Sometimes it was in the same room but a different line, and sometimes it was completely different areas. A lot of times the competitive food program actually had more points of service, and when you have a school that has, you know, 1,800 students, maybe 67 are qualified for free and reduced, and you only have maybe one point of service or two points of service for your main meal, for your national school lunch meal, and you only have about a 35-minute period to get them all through the line, time is a barrier, and access to the meal is actually a barrier for those students. So we felt that this competitive food program could be actually reinforcing the stigma, and we felt it was an equity issue. So because I've been working with the school district so many years, and my department has actually funded interventions in the school district from salad bars, we've worked on increasing the enrollment in national school lunch. We actually approached the food service director and asked if we could do a pilot to eliminate the a la carte at one high school. And we agreed, and we hired staff, and actually through a nonprofit, San Francisco Food Systems, a nonprofit partner, hired staff to actually design an operations change. And that was piloted at Balboa High in 2008 and 2009. Because of the success with that one, we decided to go ahead and pilot two more schools, and we then moved into a middle school situation, and then we also moved into another school, which was Lowell High School, which actually has lower free and reduced percentage of the students and actually had very high competitive food sales. So we tried to come up with models that would fit different schools, because every school is different. And what we found was that this elimination of a la carte increased participation in national school lunch. It expanded the points of service. The menu choice were expanded for national school lunch, and only reimbursable meals were available. The operations at the pilot schools were the most efficient in the district, and so the district decided to roll it out to all middle and high schools in 2010. And that is the policy and environmental change we are evaluating. The district, in order to do this, our district had to invest in a computerized point of sale system that it was necessary so that the real-time sales from all these different points of service at a school could be captured. So right now we're working on this evaluation, the system-wide elimination of a la carte. Our hypothesis is that that eliminating a la carte foods in competition with national school lunch reimbursable meals in school lunch environments in conjunction with the implementation of POS system and electronic prepayment will increase student participation in NSLP and improve financial efficiencies. We aim to assess the quantitative changes in NSLP participation by income level before and after the removal of competitive foods, and assess the quantitative changes in actually the entire food service program's operating costs and revenue before and after the intervention, and evaluating whether the elimination of competitive foods resulted in a positive impact on school finances. So we will we are looking at the data for participation disaggregated by students' status, NSLP status, and we're doing an entire audit of the expenses and revenues for 09-10 and 10-11 to determine the profit loss for all of the different levels of school. It's a little more complicated than you'd think because the 9-10, as you remember, that the rolling out of a point-of-sale system was part of it. It was an entire enterprise software that was rolled out in 10-11. So that is, we have to actually go back into the legacy software to pull out the, to do the audit of the expense and revenues from the previous year. But the expenses will include food, labor, and benefits. And 09-10 expenses will be allocated to either NSLP or the a la carte program because, as I said, cost accounting is not required. And then the revenue will include federal and state reimbursements as well as cash payments for those reimbursable meals. Our preliminary findings have shown that overall there's been an increase of 25% in the number of meals served in middle and highs. These are reimbursable meals. Increase in the percent participation of students from all payment categories, free, reduced, and paid. The largest increase in the number of is in the number of free meals served, and the large percentage increases in the number of paid meals. For the revenue side, the preliminary findings suggest that an increase in revenue from the reimbursable meals in conjunction with a decrease in the operating expenses, it's greater than the loss of revenue from a la carte food sales. So our next step is to complete the analysis of the participation and also look at the impact of open and closed campuses, multiple meal periods. There's only a couple of our middle schools have actually multiple meal periods, and only one of our high schools have multiple meal periods, and then the demographics of the school. And for our analysis of the revenue, we'll look at especially looking at the loss of a la carte versus the revenue gain from federal, state reimbursements and cash payments, and the impact on the labor and food cost. So in closing, I just would like to reiterate the need to consider the impact of competitive foods to school food equity. The impact of competitive foods may include a decreased student participation in NSLP and reduced school meal program revenue, and that policy and program interventions focusing on competitive foods should promote increased NSLP participation and increased revenue to the school meal programs. Thank you.
Okay, at this time we'd like to get the audience involved, and it's your time to ask questions. You have probably about 10 minutes, so just kind of direct your questions to a particular person. Well, okay, we'll start. Yeah.
First, I should just start out by saying that making sure that the policy is actually being enforced or fully implemented was part of the screening process. So we didn't look at districts that, you know, have the policy but wasn't being enforced. They were screened out. But we did hear a lot about the importance of having a champion in school, which was one of the slides that I mentioned. Food service directors consistently said there's got to be somebody in the building that really is a champion for that cause. We did not see, for example, the PTA being instrumental in enforcement. We actually specifically asked and had probes about, you know, what the PTA was responsible or somehow involved for enforcing. And that just didn't play out in these particular districts, in these eight districts. There was somebody on the ground in the building that really was a champion.
And this person also, I mean, there were many machines involved, and whether or not, you know,
in general, I think what we saw was either the principal or the food service director was a champion, and we did ask about vending contracts, and some schools had exclusive contracts and other schools didn't, but across the board we heard about the importance of working with your vendors, and even some schools included them in the policy development process.
So let's have somebody on this side. Yeah, go ahead.
It's a mix. The question was around, you know, if we only have around 45% participating in school lunch, where are the other ones eating? And I think at our middle and at our high schools, we know through a different research that was done that about 1 in 5 kids are not, students are not eating lunch, which is a big problem. And at our middle, and we have open campuses on almost all of our high schools. So this is... But if you don't have money, you're not going to be able to eat, and that's the challenge. And I think at our middle schools, I think it's probably the same. A lot of the kids are not eating.
Okay, gentleman at the back. Yeah, I'll get to you.
Actually, we haven't taken the data out that way. We have it, and it's something that's on our list to do. It would actually, if it was chocolate, whole milk, or 2% milk, it would be included in that high-fat milk category. It wasn't included for this analysis in the sugar-sweetened beverage category. But it's a big issue. You know, the IOM guidelines, nutrition standards for school competitive foods and beverages, put limits on sugars and fats in milks. And we still see a wide availability of flavored milks in schools. So one of the questions that I at least have as a researcher is I'm interested to see what USDA does with their national guidelines relative to the flavored milks in particular, because they may be low fat, but they may still have a lot of sugars in them from the flavoring. So it's a really good question, something I think needs further research.
Yeah.
Clearly, again, you had only one line, so it was more efficient. I know that, they choose that, But are the more the high school students choosing to eat at school because you are now providing a better quality of food for them?
Thank you for that question. In our pilots, and actually in the intervention, remember how I said the competitive program was actually being assembled on site? There was more labor involved. So it was actually completely a different program than our main meal, which is our national school lunch meal. When we eliminated a la carte, we actually kept that on-site assembly. So now the students that were qualified for free and reduced, or any of them, were able to actually get more freshly assembled meals at school. And we have done research asking the students, you know, their input, and they absolutely prefer the meals that are assembled on site. They think it's fresher, it's more appealing. And we're actually moving into another series of, you know, interventions and hopefully system change that will have more on-site assembly. Right now we're calling it assembly. I mean, some places would probably call it cooking, but bringing in, but, you know, everybody has different definitions for these terms, right? And so for us, it's like freshly assembled salads, teriyaki bowls that are prepared on site, and things like that. So that is what the students that were formerly not able to access unless they had money are now able to access as a reimbursable meal. So absolutely improving the quality is something that has to be part of the conversation.
They get it back.
Mine's more of a comment slash encouragement. I actually do welcome all this for a national food service organization. And while I find qualitative information very compelling, because that's my background in public health, and I really think it would be great if everyone just thought it was a joke to it to serve healthy food. But what I find most challenging in my position is always providing those revenue numbers. That even food service organizations in these schools have to make money. Because they employ thousands of employees and they want to keep their business viable. So we have to always consider those revenue numbers. Those are so important. I would venture to guess that the reason only 2% of those people are Christians are, you know, have these robust wellness programs is because we haven't proven yet that that you can still be competitive and make money even while employing these wellness policies. So I really think that sort of public health people have to get in the mind of our businesses and understand what makes them work in order to forward these policies. So just an encouragement. I love seeing numbers so that I can use them as well. So thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Go ahead.
Question relates to competitive foods. What I got is from the investigators here that this is all survey research. Are you as investigators or any investigators in this field physically going to these schools and doing site assessments of the outlets?
Michael.
Not related to the school program, the school lunch program, that's
fine. Michael.
Then you withdrawn from the tobacco wars.
Well, in Connecticut, actually, they audit. The State Department of Education does on-site audits to ensure compliance. So I think partnering with the food service does work. And the audits that haven't found non-compliance to be an issue in Connecticut, at least. But my wife is also an educator, so I know that teachers often do not comply with school-level policies about competitive foods.
Not to be cynical, but
no, I agree with you.
Physical site assessments in there as investigators.
So,
are you aware of any research going on?
In California, actually, there's been quite a few studies led by Samuelson Associates and some other groups out here that have actually done used food needs, and they've actually gone into schools and actually done objective analyses. I believe the Alliance for a Healthier Generation has also done specific in-school food audits as well. So there are definitely some groups out there who have done those types of studies. And if you want to give me your information, I'd be happy to send you some of those papers and point you in their direction. I think from a methodological standpoint, that's the ideal. I mean, if we have the resources to do it with bridging the gap, we absolutely would be going into those schools and doing objective analysis of what's actually being sold as opposed to relying on self-report. It's one of the strongest limitations that we find with secondary data analysis and working with school data. So it's a great point.
Can I just add one thing? I just wanted to add one thing. I think it goes back to the enforcement. And it's a challenge. I mean, you could have, I know because I've been working for 10 years, you know, with one school district, and at one point you can have a really great champion and a principal, and if that principal gets elevated to a higher, you know, position in the district and a new one comes in, then maybe they're focusing on something else, it could revert back. So it takes diligence at the local level and at the school level, and it's a challenge. I'll be very interested to see what is put into the new rules for wellness policies around evaluation and actually targeting somebody in the school district that actually has to be responsible for that evaluation.
Okay, you have a question.
Well, coming from a food industry perspective, my name is Laura Steck, and I've been working on this issue with a company that's trying to create a new product, merging the commodities with local foods on the peninsula. We didn't make it for a couple of reasons, but I do know that the vendors or the food service providers, companies and clients that are doing studies in schools, for instance, are definitely that's what's starting. But just a general number, which is amazing, we were required to produce a product for the school, which included a soup, a spoon, the bread, the whole grain, the napkin, and milk. And as a company, we had to sell it to Sodexo for 90 cents, and 22 cents of that was the milk.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually had to produce a whole bunch for, 68 cents or something. So you can see how, like, pay for cost of food when you're doing these types of teaching in schools? Anybody aware of any grant that covers the food cost?
We'll just have one more question, then if you want to converse with the speakers, you can do so. One more question. Okay, first on the back. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to adjourn, but if you want to talk with the speaker after, you can. Thank you for your time.